The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. In terms of monsters, one only has to look at the guest list of Donald Trump at the Mar-a-Lago. He has turned his second White House, the alternative White House, the Avenue White House, into a place to welcome foreign autocrats that he loves to celebrate. Earlier this month, Viktor Orban came to Mar-a-Lago and was extensively praised by Trump, saying that there's nobody that's better, smarter, or a better leader than Viktor Orban, and that he's the boss. Now, that meeting is a very curious thing, because one would ask, why is a foreign prime minister of Hungary visiting Mar-a-Lago instead of the White House, and also Trump's effusive praise. But as we know, Trump has a long history of praising dictators and autocrats, whether they be friends of the United States or not. It includes figures like, Vladimir Putin, President Xi, but also leaders in the Philippines and elsewhere. In fact, Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly, in an interview with CNN, sort of fleshed this out a little bit by saying that, Trump had told them Hitler did some good things. And Trump specified that this was involving economic growth. And I think more worryingly, Trump admired how Der Führer commanded the loyalty of his generals. That's perhaps not shows the limits of Trump's history, understanding of history, because I think there is at least a few generals that were involved in the coup attempt to assassinate Hitler in 1944. But in any case, so Trump's relationship with dictatorship is certainly something that's very worrying and is frequently brought up as an argument against him being president, very disqualifying. But as with so many things with Trump, I think it's important to separate out the personal from the more broadly historical or structural. And in particular, many of his attitudes are not unique to Trump, but show up more broadly on the American right. And this brings us to this week's guest, Jacob Brunn, who has a new book out called America Last, which is a history of the American right's relationship with foreign dictators. And I want to take up with Jacob, his book, which I will strongly recommend. It's a very brisk, lively read, full of a lot of information that's useful to know. And I think it the core argument about Trump reviving the traditions of the old right, I think is true and is not as widely understood as it should be. So I want to take up with Jacob both what his book documents, then also some disagreements I have with the book, which pertain to Trump's relationship, not just with the American right, but more broadly, his relationship with the sort of mainstream consensus foreign policy of the United States. And I think the disturbing thing is that there are more elements of continuity between Trump and mainstream elite opinion in America than one would like to believe. But having said all that, I want to welcome Jacob and congratulations on the book, which has just been published.
Thank you, Jeet.
So let's just get started. I mean, I think one of the points of your book is it's a history book. It goes back to more than a century, to World War I. So you want to say, what Trump is doing, inviting Viktor Orban to Mar-a-Lago and then praising him to the skies as someone who's not just an American ally, but someone to emulate. You want to say that that is not new and that this is something that has a tradition. So where do you see it coming from?
I detected the beginnings of this tradition in World War I, and I looked closely at H.L. Mencken, who we usually just think of as a provocateur and a satirist, but actually in many ways was if not the founding father of the old right, and exercised a huge influence on a number of intellectuals and published them in the American Mercury, and was friends with Albert J. Nock, who was a mentor to William F. Buckley Jr. And Mencken during World War I didn't simply say that the United States should remain neutral in World War I. He actively admired and lauded Kaiser Wilhelm and Prussian military autocracy as a superior society to the United States, both militarily, and he saw Germany as a cultural nation that should be emulated as well. And then I pointed out that he wrote an article for The Atlantic saying that the United States would, in fact, be well off if Germany were to conquer it. And these were not just idle musings of Mencken's, but deeply held views emerging from his own German ethnicity. Both his parents were German. And then I trace that, this old right that emerges in the 1920s, I trace it into the 1930s with the rise of America First.
Yeah, no, one thing I'm grateful for in the book is sort of giving priority to Mencken, not just as a cultural figure, but as a political thinker. And I think that's often not done because, as you mentioned, you know, Mencken, to the extent that he's remembered today in the broader culture, is as a very entertaining writer and as a great sort of cultural polemicist and as a great sort of critic of various faults in American society. And that Mencken actually has a sort of, you know, transpartisan appeal, right? Like, you know, one can find celebrations of Mencken by figures like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Ralph Ellison, E.L. Doctorow, you know, people who are not traditionally associated with the right. But Mencken did also have a sort of politics, and it is sort of like sort of foundational. So to his thinking, and also to the, has been a big influence on the American right to this day. I mean, I think one thing you point out is that there's an H.L. Mencken Society, which has played a pretty formative role in the creation of what we now call the alt-right.
Yes, and the core thing about Mencken was that his contempt for democracy, it wasn't just bemusement at the madding crowd. He really thought that there was a hierarchy of individuals and loathed democracy as raising inferior men into power. And that, I think, is at the core of this hatred of what we would call liberalism or classical liberalism, the idea that men are created equal. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the alt-right believes that. And you see that again and again in the writings. No, all men are not created equal.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I mean, the sort of more, I don't know if we're going to call this serious, but the sort of political and philosophical side of Mencken was Camus Nietzsche. He was a kind of, you know, a bit of a cut-rate American Nietzsche, without perhaps the sort of philosophical grounding, but taking from Nietzsche the sort of, you know, lesson of human inequality. So as you tell the account, Mencken, you know, gains a particular prominence. Well, during the First World War, he's actually in a lot of trouble. People don't want to publish him and he's censored. But after the war, as there's a sort of backlash against the First World War, he gains a kind of prominence for his views that the United States and this sort of crusade for democracy of Woodrow Wilson was a terrible mistake. So that's part of the sort of cachet that Mencken gained, right?
Right. I mean, there was obviously there was a legitimate opposition to World War I, both on the left as well, that the idea that we shouldn't get dragged into this senseless conflict on the European continent. But what happened in the 1920s was that there was a wave of revulsion against both Woodrow Wilson and against World War I, that we had been sold a bill of goods, that this war to end all wars was in fact one conducted for the merchants of death, that none of the principles that Wilson had outlined were actually adhered to by the cynical European powers at the Treaty of Versailles, and that the stage, you know, had simply been set for new war. So in the 20s, you have Mencken, Nock, and others. Nock wrote a book called The Myth of the Guilty Nation. So they argue that, you know, we should not have allied ourselves with the democracies. But it wasn't just that Mencken and the others said we shouldn't have allied ourselves with the democracies. Again, Nock and others saw Germany as superior to the United States. Mm-hmm. That's where I would draw the division. And I've been waiting for someone to denounce my interpretation of Wilhelmine Germany, because, you know, there's been furious historical debate about whether the Prussian autocracy really was as bad as it was made out to be. And I was sort of purveying a vision that Heinrich Mann, the brother of Thomas Mann, had written a book, famous book, at the time, a novel called, or afterwards called, The Loyal Subject, that parodied Wilhelmine Germany. But there is an argument that there was nothing unique about Germany, mm-hmm. that in fact, all the powers sleepwalked into the war. And then there have been historians who argue that it was France that was the culprit. And Sean Meakin argues that it was Russia. So my interpretation and going back and laying the principal blame on Germany, yes, you can, there's plenty of fodder to debate that. But what I do see happening with this revisionist wave is that you see successive revisionist waves on the right, each what I call blaming America, a wave of revisionism after World War I, a wave of revisionism after World War II, where the right again argues that we should not have allied ourselves with Great Britain against Hitler because it simply brought the Soviet Union to conquer Eastern Europe. And then a third, what I call the third wave of revisionism from Patrick Buchanan after the end of the Cold War, arguing that we are to blame for the right, for the rise of Vladimir Putin's dictatorship. So that was my historical take on all this.
I mean, some sort of connection with historical revisionism is very much part of the tradition of the old right and has continued. And then perhaps we'll return to this point in a little bit. I just want to go back to, like, you know, so Mencken and the revisionists sort of lay this groundwork of basically having a critique of the foreign policy of Woodrow Wilson, seen as, you know, the progressive tradition, saying that, you know, like, that did not work and, you know, was a disaster, and that America needs to be more unilateralist. So I mean, that all, you know, one could disagree with it, but it's not necessarily pro-authoritarian. As you say, the pro-authoritarian dimension is holding up Kaiser Wilhelm. But this sort of changes as well, like, especially in the 1920s, when it's not just Kaiser Wilhelm, the sort of, you know, the crisis of the First World War and the failed settlement of Versailles, you know, created room, new authoritarians to emerge, first with Mussolini and then with sort of Franco and Hitler. So how do the figures of the right coming out of that, you know, Mencken tradition, the old right, how do they react to these new authoritarian forces who are basically saying, you know, we're the ones who are going to protect you from anarchy and working class militancy and communism?
And cultural decadence.
And cultural decadence, yes.
Which was a huge theme of the Nazis, as there was this backlash to the Weimar era of the 1920s and early 30s, when it seemed to the upstanding burghers of Germany that it was anything goes in the big cities such as Berlin. So yes, American conservatives, again, didn't simply view Hitler with neutral or Mussolini. They actively embraced them. I pointed to Richard Washburn Child, who was Warren Harding's ambassador to Rome, and who lauded Mussolini as a force against cultural decadence, that he embodied manly virility. And Mussolini, like Orban today, demanded that Italian men procreate, that you needed more Italians. They embraced Franco. That was Merwin Hart, the New York businessman, and others were very enthusiastic about his battle against communism and the throne and altar conservatism that he represented. And then there was, of course, Hitler, who William Randolph Hearst and Charles Lindbergh, among others, embraced. Again, not simply as a neutral figure, but someone who represented the future, who was superior to the debilities of Western democracy. And that I think is key to the right and remains key today.
Yeah, no, I think your work, along with, like, emerging generation of scholars like David Walsh, is doing very good work in sort of documenting just how pervasive pro-fascist opinion was in the 20s and 30s, and that what people sometimes think of as the sort of boundaries between the respectable mainstream conservative and the pro-fascist far right, they actually were porous borders, that people sort of slipped in between these two camps quite readily. And it's very, you know, not uncommon for people that we would now consider fascist thinkers or fascist fellow travelers to have access to sort of, you know, mainstream venues. So I think that's very useful. And I think the other perhaps very good corrective that your book does is, you know, I think there's often a myth that, well, you know, after Pearl Harbor, this was all over, right? Like the sort of unilateralist tradition, the pro-fascist people, they were kind of discredited and they went away. Is that actually what happened?
No, it isn't. Part of the problem is that we've sort of allowed the right to write the history, as it were. Mm. What I discovered is that after World War I, the far right figures immediately began beavering away at the myth of the good war. And they argued in a series of books published by Regnery Publications, which is a mainstream conservative publishing house that was founded after World War II. They argued that the United States had committed war crimes against Germany that were as bad or worse than anything the Nazis had perpetrated. And I also looked at the role of Senator Joseph McCarthy, whose pioneering contribution was to argue that the Nazi murder of G.I. Joes who had surrendered at the Battle of Bulge and Malmedy in 1944 was in fact trumped up by Jewish lawyers at the War Department, that these had been trumped up confessions. And McCarthy, you know, said to in one meeting, would you want to be questioned by this man, Rosenfeld? I mean, and he called these lawyers 39ers. He thought up every disparaging term that he could for these Jewish lawyers. And that, to me, was an incredibly telling incident.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it sort of, you know, indicates that sort of pre-war pro-fascist sentiment hadn't quite gone away, but had, you know, started to take different forms. Although, you know, like one aspect was that, you know, once American foreign policy became anti-communist, you know, under Harry Truman, the impulse towards unilateralism was somewhat muted, or, you know, they were able to reconceive of an American foreign policy that they could, of interventionism that they could support, particularly if it was like involved in wars in the third world against Asia rather than sort of Europe, right? This is the sort of, you know, there's a kind of pathway from isolationist to Asialationist to, you know, the kind of a super cold warrior.
Definitely. The conquest of China by Mao's forces provided an escape hatch for the right. I had been warning, you know, about the infiltration of inferior Asian blood into the United States for decades. And Chiang Kai-shek became the right-wing hero in the 1950s.
Yeah. So there was a kind of, I mean, this is a moment where perhaps the right does shift, and there is maybe a period where there's more continuity between the right and sort of mainstream liberalism, that some of the sort of figures on the right can at least, you know, be working on sort of broadly Cold War policy, right?
Like, I would be careful there, because one of the things that occurred with McCarthy was that the right had been denounced as being pro-fascist in the late 30s and early 40s, and even put on trial by Franklin Roosevelt. And they wanted payback after World War II. And the way to do that was to argue that the liberals were the true totalitarians and traitors, that Alger Hiss had given away fundamental American secrets at Yalta, that the New Deal was riddled with Jewish traitors. So McCarthy and William F. Buckley went on the attack now against liberals, and they and against Dwight D. Eisenhower, of course, arguing that you needed rollback. They propagated a much more radical version of conservatism, or what you might want to call right-wing radicalism.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Oh, it always seemed to be kind of like curiously split or divided in the sense of both wanting to be super anti-communist, but then like skeptical of the institutions like the army and the CIA that are sort of, you know, the bulwarks of the national security state, and sometimes skeptical of particular military interventions. I mean, I'm always struck by the fact that the John Birch Society was against the Vietnam War, but that's because he thought Washington was controlled by communists. So like, why are you fighting communists in Saigon when you should be fighting them in Washington, D.C.? So, I mean, there's like many sort of curious mental quirks within this tradition. You take up the issue again, though, with these figures on the right starting to celebrate regimes that are seen as bulwarks against communism within the context of the Cold War. So we have, you know, like apartheid era South Africa, as well as, you know, less remembered, but Rhodesia. But also, as you mentioned, you know, sort of Taiwan. We need to, you know, unleash Chiang and let him do the fighting for us. And then, you know, starting in the 70s, Pinochet, And then, you know, in the 80s, various leaders of death squads, as you mentioned, Jonas, in Angola. What do you think is the, what was drawing the right to these figures and these regimes?
Fetishizing strength and the strong man. It wasn't just realpolitik, you know, where Franklin Roosevelt would say about Somoza that he was our son of a bitch. They went further than that. They, Wilmore Kendall writing to the political philosopher Leo Strauss about how the Dominican Republic was, you know, some kind of much more complicated than simply mass terror. I mean, they were delusional. And the turning Savimbi into a combination of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln in the 1980s when Gene Kirkpatrick addressed CPAC, calling him a great poet, a fighter, a much greater man than Nelson Mandela. They had it all backwards. I mean, that's what I find the most abhorrent and repellent aspect of this, in many ways, was the embrace of South Africa, of a regime based essentially on Nazi race law, and that they would hail Savimbi and denounce Mandela. I mean, it's just an inversion of reality.
No, absolutely. And just as to finish up the chronology, we have this long-standing tradition on the right of admiration for these strong men, you know, antipathy towards democracy, held, I think, a little bit in check by the Cold War. Like, I mean, I do think that there were periods where, you know, particularly Ronald Reagan and Bush Jr. did try to invoke some sort of, you know, pro-democratic rhetoric. But, you know, with the end of the Cold War and with the collapse of Bush's foreign policy, once, you know, the true extent of the disaster in both Iraq and, to be honest, Afghanistan became clear, there was a kind of reversion to the older policy, right? Is that fair to say that, you know, what you're really talking about is a kind of, you know, what Freud would call the return of the repressed?
Definitely. And the keeper of the flame is Patrick J. Buchanan, who writes, you know, who writes America First, Second, and Third in 1990, and who writes a book arguing that we shouldn't have intervened in World War II, let alone World War I. He embodies all of these old right arguments and keeps them alive for Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think Buchanan, I've said this before, you know, like, he is a sort of key figure. He is the, you know, just as William Jennings Bryan prefigured FDR, you know, Buchanan prefigured Trump, and is like Buchanan's whole life, you know, like, he grew up in a household where, you know, they admired Franco, Father Foglin, Douglas MacArthur, you know, like all, and Joseph McCarthy, all the gods of the old right. And then, as you mentioned, you know, like reviving the slogan of America First, and but also reviving, you know, that sort of tradition of World War II revisionism. Yeah, I mean, he has the whole package deal. And I would mention the sort of alliance he formed with the economist Murray Rothbard, who very much also conceptualized himself as the keeper of the flame of the old right, and then really the keeper, the continuation of the tradition of H.L. Mencken. I think that is really the story of your book. And as I said, it's a very compelling story and the true story. Now, you had mentioned along the way, you know, there we have these disagreements. So in your book, I was kind of a bit surprised by this. Like, you basically, because I don't think it's necessary to your argument, but you basically hold World War I as a responsibility of Kaiser Wilhelm. And that's perhaps a point of view that was very popular between 1914 and 1918 in the Allied countries. I'm not so sure how many people hold to that now.
Well, there was an interesting piece in the New York Review of Books recently, which said, you know, this gets back to the idea of a special path in German history.
Yeah.
But there was something unique about what Bismarck created in 1870 after German unification. And I reverted to an older interpretation that there was something rotten at the core of the Kaiserreich. And that, you know, if you look at Kaiser Wilhelm and his erratic actions, his racism, his anti-democratic views, I thought in the end, looking at World War I, that, yeah, the Kaiser was the main, in many ways, the main engineer, maybe not consciously of the war, but there was, you know, this thirst for it, Germany's place in the sun, the rabid nationalism that had infected Germany. And I don't think when you look at the novels about the era, which reflect that sentiment, I get a little queasy when I look at it. So yes, I did offer that interpretation. Obviously, World War I, the war over the origins of the war is never going to end.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, I don't want to spend too much time litigating, you know, who caused World War I. But I mean, I will point out an alternative explanation, which I sort of hold to, which is I don't actually think that there's a special path of Germany in the sense that Germany is outside of the history of the West. I think Germany is, like, you know, one of the core Western nations, and there's a lot of continuity between, you know, disagreeable elements that one could see in Germany of the late 19th and early 20th century of nationalism, imperialism, that are, you know, like, held in common across the board. And even, like, the sort of anti-democratic elements. I mean, I do not think the Britain that held on to Ireland and India, or the United States that of Jim Crow, you know, were stellar examples of liberal democracy. I mean, there were none. Democracy was something that was in the process of being born. So you know, like, the alternative of the World War story of World War I is that you had a system of imperial rivalry that all the great powers joined to, both out of self-interest, but also of ideology, that there was an ideology of imperialism. And that the United States itself, with its holdings in the Philippines and its, you know, sphere of influence in the Western Hemisphere, was not exempt from that. And that once you have, you know, like, system of imperial rivalry with these sort of Darwinian ideas of, you know, like, finite resources, zero-sum game, you know, like, you're going to have war at some point. And, like, a lot of people before World War I had a, you know, strong sense that the war was coming. But Kaiser Wilhelm was, you know, a terrible person for all the reasons you'll find in your book. I'm just not a fan of the others. Speaking personally, like, you know, my great-grandfather fought in the First World War. He was, like, a, you know, Sikh from India, you know, brought in to fight in Europe. And then, you know, later the family received some, like, land in Africa. And so I conceptualize World War I as part of that imperial system. And while I don't think Germany deserved a place in the sun, I'm not quite sure why Great Britain deserved to be the, you know, the empire on which the sun never set either.
Well, I won't prolong that. What I do want to quickly say is I was amused when you talked about in your essay in The Nation, my views on Germany. You ascribed a sort of Germanophobe to my father emigrating in 1940. It's actually, I'm more of a Germanophile, but I am shaped by the memory of what happened in Weimar Germany and in Nazi Germany. That is really the background to this book that I think a lot of the reviewers are not picking up, which is that I am concerned, apprehensive, maybe if you, a conservative would probably say paranoid, that we are treading down a similar path today.
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah. I just think, you know, it's a historiographical question, but I'd be wary of, like, projecting onto the German past stuff that, you know, because of the events of the 1930s. Like, I think that there's ways in which one has to, like, you know, always be aware that there were multiple paths that were open to Germany. And I mean, on that point, like, it is something I mentioned in my Nation column, which I'll link to. Well, Germanophobe. I think in your book, you give a very particular emphasis to the sort of German-American component of the story. And I think you have a kind of a point there in the sense that, and it's something that's often ignored. I mean, there is a sort of Midwestern German tradition of which Mencken is part of, but which was, you know, sort of like not really seen anymore. Like, people don't talk about it, but it did have these, you know, very disagreeable, you know, unilateralist and, you know, like in the 30s, and later pro-fascist tendencies. So I think you highlight that. And I think that that is there and true. I just wonder to what extent, like, is there a German-American exceptionalism, or were many of these attitudes kind of like more broadly shared? And the point, I mean, I sort of briefly alluded to But you look at sort of the founding fathers of, mainstream American foreign policy, Cold War liberalism, Dean Acheson and George Kennan. And I got to say, these guys didn't love democracy once more than Mencken did. and in particular, their attitude towards race, towards decolonization, towards South Africa, to me, it seems more continuous with the right than I think a lot of people are comfortable in acknowledging.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right, because, Acheson, Douglas Brinkley wrote a good book about Acheson's post-Truman career.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sympathetic to Rhodesia, and Kennan harbored some pretty dark views himself. So
Kennan's critique of South Africa was that it actually failed to live up to the ideals of apartheid. He basically said, apartheid is a beautiful goal, but, the South Africans are actually, bringing the Black Africans, the Afrikaners, they're bringing the Black Africans to do work in their houses, and there should actually be more separatism. True apartheid has never been tried. It's an amazing sentiment.
He also wanted the Soviets to invade Denmark because he was so opposed to the 1960s Cultural Revolution and the hippies.
A detachment of Soviet Navy could easily
rouse them.
And one of the kind of American apartheid, he did sort of flirt with this idea that all African Americans should be given their own state or states. And
but these were not just to bring up the dirty laundry of
some prominent people, but I actually think that if one were to do it, a broader history of anti-democratic sentiment, particularly relating to foreign policy, it would go beyond the right, which you document so well in your book. And, in the my column, I did actually point towards a very good scholar, David Schmitz, who's written two books precisely on this topic, Thank God They're on Our Side, and The United States and Right-Wing Dictators. And then both these books kind of, do show that, again, similar to the chronology of your book, but that starting with the First World War, there is a kind of fear of revolution and of the danger of both working class and peasant militancy that could overthrow the liberal capitalist order, and that United States would be well advised to align with right-wing dictators. And that what Schmitz emphasizes, and I think this is absolutely true, is that this is a bipartisan tradition, with the exception that occasionally democratic governments will start to realize, these fascist regimes are actually a threat. One saw that with, Franklin Roosevelt, and I again later with Jimmy Carter, and, these are always contested things, but there's a broad bipartisan tradition of aligning with right-wing dictators and even seeing them, and not just this is a necessary evil, but actually pushing for, coups, and as the, Kennedy and Johnson administration did in the 1970s, to install in place right-wing regimes. So I think that this is it's a broader problem.
Yes. I was focused more narrowly on this, obviously, because of the Trump phenomenon, that we've never had a former president or a president who wanted to implant these foreign dictatorial practices into America.
Yeah. No, that is right. And that's something, I talked to David Schmitz about this, and he emphasized that he would argue there's both continuity and discontinuity. And the continuity is seeing authoritarian dictators as, useful allies of America. The discontinuity is that it was prior done for systematic reasons. It was done with this conceptualization of a liberal world order. Liberal meaning, free trade and capitalism. And that if democracy has to give way to maintain this, then, democracy is a secondary choice. With Trump, it's all personal. It's he likes Warfam, he likes Putin, and he wants to be like them. And it is a very novel and disturbing aspect that he wants to, bring this home. Although, what I would say is, there's almost a classic blowback strategy. You have a foreign policy lead that's very comfortable with right-wing dictators, and maybe it's only a matter of time that some of those attitudes start coming home.
I hadn't thought of that. I guess because I saw Trump as we were talking earlier, in this older tradition and perhaps influenced by his father, as you were suggesting, and that his father too comes out of this German tradition.
Yeah.
I don't think Trump has been mined enough, actually. I mean, the talk about him having Mein Kampf next to his bedside, which he basically admitted. And then his father going on the Ku Klux Klan rally in New York. I wonder, you know, I didn't have the time to delve into this, but it seems to me that that would be a fruitful area of inquiry.
Yeah, no, I think there's an evidence maybe of both stories here, like your story of the return of the repressed. And I do think Trump's family history is part of that, that he is part of this, you know, Germano-American so-called isolationist, but really unilateralist tradition, the old right tradition, and that he's brought it back. I mean, I think that is one part of the story. The other part is, like, how did he come to rise? I will say for your book, it does provide ample evidence for this, what I call the blowback thesis, which is, I mean, I do think you rightfully acknowledge that the sort of failures of George Bush's global war on terror discredited the, you know, Republican foreign policy elite and was part of the pathway towards Trump.
No question. I still think that the Iraq war was a hinge point.
Yes.
But some other people have said to me, well, also the Clinton era trade deals were very significant as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. One already saw that with the sort of pro-Trump of Perot, like, you know, harnessing many of these same sentiments. Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's sort of multiple pathways or there's sort of multiple connections. One other thing in your book, which I think like maybe could be is worth revisiting, is when you talk about Jean Kirkpatrick, like you've quoted her as initially when he was first asked to leave Reagan, she said, well, I'm an AFL-CIO Democrat. And then Kirkpatrick becomes one of the great villains of your book because you document like, you know, some of her hair-raising, you know, comments, basically trying to exculpate the murder of nuns in El Salvador by saying, well, they're activists, and her, you know, fawning over Savimbi, and her, you know, basically belief that Argentine had the right to take over the Falklands. But Jean Kirkpatrick, I mean, she was a Cold War liberal. She wasn't lying. She was an AFL-CIO Democrat, and that was compatible with, like, all sorts of very, you know, pro-authoritarian attitudes. And so to me, like, I think that is worth unpacking.
Definitely. That's a fair point. I think that Kirkpatrick did keep moving to the right, though she never lost her affection for Hubert Humphrey. But she also, you know, what hasn't been brought out, and I probably should have brought out more in the book, Patrick Buchanan wrote a column praising Jean Kirkpatrick because she was opposed to immigration, she was essentially became much more of an isolationist after the Cold War ended. She wrote an article in the National Interest saying that America should come home and stop fighting abroad.
That is interesting. And yeah, I mean, there's ways in which her kind of very cold-blooded realpolitik is, you know, compatible with Buchanan. And there, I mean, like, you know, speaking, you know, as someone on the left, there are parts of that social democratic tradition that also, you know, feed into Trump, like in terms of, you know, skepticism about trade, even skepticism about immigration, which, you know, has been part of the sort of union division as well. So, I think my broader argument is like, one should try not to be so partisan about such things and realize that, you know, like these traditions kind of feed into each other. And there are ways in which the lines, not just between the mainstream and the far right, but also between left and right, they're a little bit more blurry than I think people want to allow.
Definitely. And, you know, I get attacked among the conservatives because I didn't dwell on the history of left-wing affinity for the Soviet Union or Fidel Castro's Cuba. But I thought that that had been pounded into the ground and that there really wasn't any point in dwelling on it. And in fact, I think that the right-wing fervor for these regimes was more widespread and institutionalized than it was on the left.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I don't quite see, you know, even though, like, you know, here at The Nation, there's this, you know, very shameful history of Stalinist apologetics in the 30s and 40s. It was never quite as pervasive and found on in mainstream sources as the stuff you document in your book. And I want to perhaps end on that point, because I actually, you know, like, despite the criticisms I made, you know, like, about the issue of World War One and other things, I think this is a great book. It's also, I have to say, like, it's a great read, very brisk. Listeners will get through it quickly, and they'll learn a lot of history that's useful to know that they haven't heard before.
Thank you.
Thank you.